what the pandemic reveals about humankind. Even as we move through our daily lives, dealing with the inconvenience and fears tied to the COVID-19 pandemic, we're also aware on some level that these are profound and historic times, and that as we live through the pandemic, others are studying it. Sociologists and anthropologists see the pandemic through a different lens than others, and it's revealing information about the human condition in the 21st century. Think science skepticism, crisis decision-making, risk-taking and safety, wide inequalities in health and disease. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss the ways in which this pandemic is drawing back the curtain on humankind. What are we learning about ourselves as a society? How will this knowledge guide us in the future? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The pandemic has changed the way we live our lives in so many ways. Is that for real? Is that forever? What will it mean more broadly in the future? Today, we're going to discuss the pandemic's impact on our society and culture, and we're going to try to look at it through the lens of a social scientist. Joining me, Nancy Riley, who is chair of the Department of Sociology and a professor of social sciences at Bowdoin College. Her research and teaching interests have focused on China, Asian Americans, gender, population, and public health. She is currently working on a project on the Chinese experience in Hawaii and another on gender and reproductive control across the globe. And also here, Josh Rubin, a lecturer in anthropology, American studies, and Africana at Bates College. His research is on play, popular culture, and art, and is currently finishing up a book about the politics and aesthetics of South African rugby. Hi, Nancy and Josh.
Hi.
Hi, and thank you for having me.
Sounds like both of your research has you traveling to some pretty terrific places when we're not in pandemic mode. As always, we want to hear from you. What do you think social scientists will be studying in the years ahead about these unusual times? Have you noticed changes in your own behavior or in the behavior of others around you? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. It strikes me, Nancy, as a sociologist, that one of the biggest phrases of this pandemic is a phrase that uses the word social, which is social distancing. How is the social compact affected by social distancing?
Well, you know, I think that's a really good way to think about it, is to think about that word social. And I also think this other phrase, we're all in it together, is another one that's used. And I think about this as a sort of the way that we're divided and similar. So we're similarly worried about the virus. We're similarly worried about other parts that, you know, our lives that have been affected by the pandemic. But we're also separated by a lot of things, and so that the way that we experience this pandemic, I think, has been very different depending on where we are in the society, whether it's about age or geography. So Maine and New York City are very different, but also gender and class and race as well, and those things have really mattered greatly in how people have experienced the last few months.
What have you noticed?
Well, I think the first thing I noticed, partly because of my own work, was the ways that Asian Americans were targeted in this sort of this notion of the Chinese virus, or that somehow Chinatowns should be off limits. So very early, long before it had really come to the U.S., or at least before we knew it had come to the U.S., people were canceling, you know, any trips to Chinatown. I know somebody who's Thai from Thailand and has a restaurant in southern New Jersey, totally not affected by anything, and who's lost 85% of her clientele, of her customers, within a week because people were afraid that they'd get sick by going to eat at this Thai restaurant. And so those kind of things, which remind us that there's underlying assumptions about different groups in our society, were very, very obvious to me from the get-go. And that's really because I've been looking at the place of Asians in the United States for a while now.
And Josh, you're an anthropologist, and I think traditionally and usually anthropologists are looking back at civilizations of the past, trying to figure out what they can from found objects. And I'm wondering how the study of anthropology applies to living in the society today.
Yeah, so there are different kinds of anthropologists, actually. There are anthropological archaeologists who do the sort of work that you're describing. But I'm trained as a sociocultural anthropologist, and people who work in my subdiscipline are fascinated by the world as it exists, the world as it might exist in the future, the world as it existed 50 or 100 years ago. And so our locus is very much in particularly around the performances and actions that people are engaging in the present. And so what I'm finding really fascinating, and I think this is a nice extension of Nancy's point, is the way that people are assessing what they call, what they regard as risk. And how risk might be something that people think is just a list of criteria. Am I doing a risky behavior? Am I doing a less risky behavior? And that's reducible, they might think, down to statistics and likelihood. But actually, there's a lot of politics in risk. And we're in a moment of crisis. It's regarded as a temporal moment of crisis where people are making what they regard as very quick but also very hard choices about what's risky and what isn't. And in that moment, and Nancy's point is, I think, related to this, that prejudices get smuggled in very easily, and stereotypes and preconceptions about what's going to be a risky behavior and what's not going to be a risky behavior. And risk gets attached to bodies. It gets attached to people. And so if you encounter somebody in the street, you might regard them as more or less risky based not on some kind of internal risk calculus that we're all doing mentally, but rather on the basis of one's preconceptions and one's biases. This is anthropologist Lucas Engelmann, who's got this really beautiful idea where he said, every day that we live right now is haunted by virtual simulated epidemics. And what he's saying, I think, there is that we look and we check and see, you know, like, are the cases in Maine going up or are they going down? Are people social distancing appropriately or are they not? And we're wondering this across the country and across the world. And so in doing so, we're assessing our behavior in the present and we're looking forward to our potential future health and the health of our communities. And we're also looking back. I find myself thinking in 2-week increments. I don't know if other people are doing the same thing where it's like, what have I done in the past 2 weeks? All right. So event X that happened three weeks ago is now in the category of safe. But now I have to worry about this thing that happened 3 days ago for 2 weeks. Right. And I think that living in that cycle is a really profound way that people have internalized risk, have internalized crisis, and potentially are exposing themselves to forms of prejudice that are socialized and virulent, but might not be something that they would embrace at other moments of their life.
And Josh, go ahead. Yeah,
I think that's an interesting way to put it, Josh. And one of the things I think about is the kind of tensions around opening up or keeping, you know, closed down because of the risk of the virus versus the economic risk. So it's not like there's just one risk. There's, you know, different risks. And it depends in some ways on where you stand in the society and what matters more to you, and what do you think is going to hurt you or the people around you more, this risk or that risk? And so, again, we have ideas that we bring with us. They didn't just develop in the last 2 months about what our priorities are. And I think that's another thing that people are assessing at a larger level as well.
And Josh, that's interesting. What Nancy said is similar to where I was going to go with my question for you, which is talking about all of us perpetually assessing our risk. Some people have the luxury of perpetually assessing their risk, and some people don't.
Right, exactly. And that the fascinating thing about that is that we might think that risk is some individual thing that we get to choose, but of course it's social. We're exposed to risk. We're placed in conditions of risk. There are people who are more or less well positioned to resist risk. I'm thinking about the ideal sort of social distancing lifestyle, and of course that's a life where you are staying in your home and you can work from home, and you may not have kids, or if you do, you have a partner or you have someone in the home who is regarded as safe, who can take care of your kid while you work. And you can get food delivered, and you can get groceries delivered. And that's such a tiny, tiny subset of the whole population of people in the United States and people in the world that other people then end up carrying risks on them as they move about.
I'm sorry, Josh.
No, please go ahead. No, I was just going to say that there are healthcare workers for example, or people who work in grocery stores who are both lauded for their service, but then also kind of feared for the risk that they carry. And that polarizing position is one that I think anthropologists have seen that people are really struggling with. It's a tremendous burden.
Well, and I was going to say, Jennifer, you said at the beginning about, you know, what does this mean going forward? I think about this a lot, the way that sometimes the invisible work that keeps our lives together, the glue that, you know, operates around us that we don't always notice or pay attention to, but we have had to notice now always, which is those people who are working at often minimum wage jobs, who are, again, as Josh says, are not able to choose to stay safe or safer, that now we know how important they are. We know how dependent we are. And I wonder, what will we remember this once we're through this pandemic? Will we remember how valuable that labor is? And will we respond to the value of that labor that we have come to recognize? I think about this. I wonder about whether or not the things that we notice so much more easily now, whether we'll still remember them further down the road.
I want to talk a little bit about science and social science. And I guess, I mean, I'll start with science skepticism. Is that something, Nancy, that you study? And how do you see that intertwined with this pandemic?
Well, I teach epidemiology and social epidemiology. And part of what epidemiologists or public health people have to recognize is the way that people are skeptical of science. We've seen this with people who are don't want their children vaccinated. So, and we've seen it in terms of climate change. That is, what evidence? How do people assess evidence? What evidence counts? What do people do with evidence? And that really differs from one person to another. And I think that science is seen as questionable in ways by certain parts of the population. And I think it can be quite dangerous, honestly. I think it's really important for us to recognize what is good evidence, that we put some trust in those people who are experts and know how to assess the evidence and the science behind some of these things, and that we act accordingly. And I'm not sure everybody agrees with me on that. So I think this has always been an issue. So, you know, if you think about any kind of disease outbreak any time during the, you know, now or in the past, people are always worried about that. And how do they protect themselves? How do they cure themselves? So they, you know, there were people who sold things that would cure you of cholera that would not cure you of cholera. So how do you know what you're getting and what somebody's trying to tell you or trying to convince you of? And I think we continue with that kind of doubt and with people trying to make it clear what it is we should or shouldn't be doing right now.
And Josh, speaking of science, I'm going to sort of pivot to a different part of science, which is the natural world. And that's something that you're looking at in the interaction between the pandemic, humankind, and the animal kingdom.
Yeah, right. So one of the things anthropologists love to think about these days is what is regarded as the limits of the human. And I know that might sound like a very kind of jargony, overly theoretical way of conceptualizing it, but the idea is pretty simple. It's that any sort of definition of the human or any definition of a person ends up excluding a really complicated social world that surrounds them. So, for example, I think what we're all realizing right now, and this is an extension of something that Nancy has said earlier, is that how deeply intertwined we are with others. How if you are in a position where you can get groceries delivered, there is somebody who is bringing you groceries. There is somebody who is sorting in the grocery store. There is somebody who has picked those groceries or provided them to you. And so there's this massive chain of interconnection with even humans. But of course, we're not just in a world with other humans. We're in a world with other animals and other things. And so anthropologists are doing some really cool work on how changing human behavior right now is impacting, for example, other species that live alongside us. So, some anthropologists are looking at how rats are changing their behavior in big cities. And I know that this has been reported in some outlets. And the fact that humans aren't doing what they usually do means that these animal species, which have no connection, no explicit connection to the coronavirus, are changing their behaviors as well. One thing that I think is kind of interesting to think about is how if you have a dog, you probably are out walking your dog, which means that you might be being more social in a public sense than many other people who have cats or who have other animals or no animals at all. And why this is a kind of nice thing to think is, well, you are not outside because of yourself. You are outside because of your relationship with this animal. And actually, I've had students write really profound papers in my Anthro 101 class about how their animals at home are adjusting to their constant presence and the family's constant presence, and sort of turning out that the animals are now a little bit tense, just like the family might be a little bit tense around each other because the animals don't have their space anymore that they had during the day. And I realize that this is not an experience that everybody shares, but it is one tiny example of how our lives are just deeply intertwined with the animal world and with other people, in a sense, and how the coronavirus has brought this to the fore.
How does this change us, Nancy, individually and collectively? Things like not hugging, not greeting people with handshakes.
Yeah, or I think about this a lot, particularly for some groups. But I think about children and what they're learning about other people. And a young person said to me recently, I'm starting to think of everybody as potentially dangerous. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is
right.
I mean, you know, that so maybe many of us will have a memory of when this was not true. But what about people who are developing and learning that this is the way you need to think about it's sort of that? I think about it young children were taught not, you know, to be careful of strangers and what that means when when children are always supposed to be suspicious of strangers. But now it's everybody, it's anybody, including dogs actually and cats, that you should be worried about that they're somehow going to hurt you. I mean, that is actually what that sort of message is. And I think that's that could have terrible consequences, I would think. But also, I think, of course, we need interaction with people. I mean, I think every one of us misses, most of us anyway, miss that kind of regular human interaction that is part of our daily lives, that even when you get a cup of coffee, but even more when we talk among our friends or our family or whatever, that we can't be doing the same way anyway now.
Josh, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, well, one of the thoughts that I have is I have a 3-year-old child at home, and all of her, she's got toy cars, and all of her toy cars are taking people to the hospital.
Oh, no.
I've been thinking quite a bit about the kind of imaginative consequences of a world where every time your child goes out, you're told, don't touch that. We can't go to the playground. You know, you might get sick there. There's kind of going back to the point about risk, there's kind of like you're constructing an imaginative world of risk for the child. And of course, that's going to influence their play. And so she has a toy fire truck, and she's saying, everyone in this fire truck is sick. Everyone, you know, this fire truck is driving people to the hospital to be safe. When we're speculating about what are the long-term consequences of coronavirus, I don't think we can just think about the economic consequences or the social consequences in a kind of immediate sense. We have to think about the way that people's patterns of sociality are getting changed, the way that the what we call in anthropology the emotional or affective dynamic of communities is getting changed, and also the imaginative world of children who are having to sort of like wrestle with sick relatives at home, or are exposed and sick themselves, or are trying to like tell stories for themselves, and all their whole social world is just full of danger and risk, or it's presented that way.
We're talking about how sociologists and anthropologists are looking at the COVID-19 pandemic. We'd love to hear what you've been thinking about as you think about how this might affect society. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Humanities Council. Using books and big ideas to foster meaningful connection across physical distance, mainehumanities.org. And Lamy Wellahan Shoes, helping people in Maine communities through their shoe donation program, gathering and distributing over 10,000 pairs of shoes to Mainers in need.
Protesters chant the name Breonna Taylor, and her aunts are processing what it means for their niece to become a national symbol. You never would think that her name would be added to a list.
A hashtag.
Nobody's safe. If this can happen to Brianna, it can happen to anybody.
I'm Ari Shapiro, reporting from Louisville, Kentucky, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up at 4 o'clock this afternoon here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public Classical brings 24/7 great classical music listening to many areas of Maine. If you love classical music, are curious about Maine Public Classical and how to find it, please visit mainepublic.org. We have stations in Portland, Bangor, Waterville, the Western Maine Bridgeton area, Down East, the Booth Bay Brunswick, and in many areas of York County. Maine Public Classical, if you love classical music, perhaps need a break from the news or just want to check it out. How to find the nearest Maine Public Classical signal available to you is at mainepublic.org. Just click on the classical drop-down and enjoy.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we have an anthropologist and a sociologist as our guest to discuss the social science perspective on the coronavirus pandemic. Josh Rubin is an anthropologist at Bates College. His current research concerns the race and gender politics of video game playtests. Nancy Riley is a professor of social sciences and chair of the sociology department at Bowdoin College. She has focused on China, Asian Americans, gender, population, and public health. As always, we want to hear from you. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to go to Alex, who's calling from Freeport. Hi, Alex. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to see if there's any discussion, because I don't hear any about any Bible prophecies regarding the pestilences and the global warming and these difficulties that we're living in. I just think that the things that we see around us and the attitudes of people around us, they're all prophesied already in 2 Timothy 3:1. It says, in the last days, critical times, hard to deal with, will be here. And then Luke 21:11, it says, there will be pestilences and food shortages and earthquakes. And I don't see or hear any discussion of that. Hey,
Alex, thank you. Yeah, really interesting perspective. And Josh, I'm going to turn to you. I mean, it does, much of what we're going through right now does seem like it's right out of the Bible.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I'm thinking of, and maybe this is getting at a part of Alex's question, is trying to find meaning in the moment of crisis. There are all sorts of meanings, right? There's scientific meaning, there's religious meaning. And I think part of what's really disorienting about our present moment is just how we all kind of feel like we're scrambling for some sort of coherence. First of all, it's important to kind of recognize that, but it's another to realize that, and I think he said processes in place. And that struck me as really profound, because one of the things that makes me a little bit anxious is that in a moment of crisis, things get decided very, very quickly. So for example, and this speaks, I think, to Nancy's work quite directly, an anthropologist has written recently about anxieties regarding wet markets in China, and the fact that people are, you know, that feelings about those kinds of anxieties are woven together with racial prejudice, but they're also prompting people to demand quick and immediate like shutdowns of those kinds of markets when what's really necessary, and actually people depend on those markets for food and they depend on those markets for their livelihood. And so of course what's necessary is kind of a slower, more gradual, more thoughtful process of engagement about how aspects of that market can be kind of regulated a little bit better and handled a little bit more cleanly. But of course that can be applied more generally, not just to those markets, but to any kind of economic process that's happening right now, even in the United States or in other countries. The key thing is to sort of say, this is a moment of crisis. We might feel like we're incredibly agitated, like decisions have to be made really quickly, but we have to be hyper aware of the fact that those decisions are made with incomplete information and may need to be revised and may have long-term consequences. And so I suppose that's kind of the gist that I drew from this, from that question, which is, you know, what kind of framing reference are we going to put to this crisis? And then what does that mean potentially for our future actions?
And and I think also it does also speak to the ways that things are interconnected. So this notion, I mean, I'm glad you brought up the wet market issue in China, Josh, because, you know, I think there's been a lot of research that shows that the situation in terms of environment and humans and the way that humans are interacting differently with the environment for various reasons, because they need the food or the wood from tree, whatever it might be, that has meant a different relationship to pathogens, but also to animals who live in those environments. And so things are interconnected. And so maybe it's not a coincidence that we have some of these things happening at the same time, because we have a changing relationship to the things around us. Just as Josh was talking about, we are not just humans living by ourselves. We are humans living in a world that is surrounded by lots of different events and different creatures.
Alex, thank you so much for your call. We're going to move on to Limerick and Margaret. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead.
Hi. I realize that one of the very negative consequences and unfortunate consequences of this pandemic is that we can't bring our own bags to the grocery store anymore. So it's multiplying the use of plastic. And plastic is one of the things that is very detrimental to this planet.
Yes.
Interesting point. Go ahead, Nancy.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that too, about how we are, I'm not sure willing is the right word, but it almost is necessitating us doing things that we otherwise wouldn't do. And using plastic at the grocery store is a good example. I'm hopeful that we'll figure out a way to remember what it is that was so important and to bring that somehow into what we're doing right now. So I've seen people make suggestions about how to not reuse our bags from home, but somehow reuse things in ways that are safe. And I agree. These are the kind of things, all the ordering that we do, you know, we do online ordering and it's shipped, you know, that's not very good for the planet either. So, yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Josh, do you have thoughts about that? I mean, talking about the natural world, are we moving backwards in terms of waste and resource use?
That's certainly a concern. A thing that I'm thinking about, too, is, well, certainly other anthropologists, not just me, and it's this incredible burden to sort of represent a discipline in this way. So thanks to you
Sorry.
And the listeners for putting up with my limited perspective. But the thing that other anthropologists have noted is that there was this sort of concerted push away from everyone using hand sanitizer and everyone being hyper vigilant about their sort of like the purity of themselves up until, you know, the coronavirus. And people were saying we're going to generate like super bugs in this way by having these kind of like really rigid practices of self purification. And now all of that stuff has kind of gone out of the window immediately. And so the question is then, and I think this is something that I can't answer, and I don't know if anyone can, is to the extent to which kind of after this crisis passes, whether people will say, well, in order to ensure that this doesn't happen again, I will continue to use hand sanitizer constantly, and I will, it's unclear which practices people will carry over from this moment into the future and what that will mean for their health and then the long-term health of other communities and then the long-term health of the planet as a whole.
Margaret, thank you for your question. If you'd like to join the conversation, we're talking about social science and the pandemic and just how society may or may not change because of it. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. If you send an email, make it brief, talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go to Kitsy, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Kitsy. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Earlier you led off with what about the loss of contact or something to that effect, you know, more handshakes and hugs. And I'm a retired parish minister and hospice chaplain, and I think about skin hunger. Those who live together in households, I mean, parents can hug their children, and, you know, those within a bubble can do this. But I think about elderly people who are alone, and I think about people also at rituals like funerals and memorial societies and weddings where people are expected to hug and to be very touchy, and that this is something, I'm living in a retirement situation where everybody is now in our own apartment, and we can come out and we can talk 6 feet apart with our masks on, but there's no hugging. And we have one person here who's just about to be 100. A couple are in their 90s or more than that. And I'm just so concerned about, I don't feel like I'm skin hungry, but I probably am. But all of those people who are, and that that's an important thing, and how that will change or not afterwards. Will we feel that being touching each other is dangerous after
right.
this is all taken care of? Thank you.
Kitsy, I really appreciate that. And I love it when I learn something new. I've never heard the expression skin hunger, and now I know it. Josh, but an anthropologist looks at rituals, and Kitsy brought up a ritual, a wedding, a funeral, when people are used to comforting each other in a certain way in our society.
Right, exactly. My family did a Passover Seder remotely, and there are questions of, you know, communion. How do you do communion when you are social distancing? And I think these are what's really important from an anthropological perspective is to see that these things are happening, but then to also sort of see the kinds of things that are happening with communities in response to them. So it's interesting to note that you do a Passover Seder remotely, but then the question is, what, you know, sending a Haggadah, you know, like a ritual text remotely, and then you're working and you've got iPads at the table, and usually iPads wouldn't be allowed at the table, but well, it's Passover, but that's the only way that it's going to work, and so we're going to allow it, and you end up kind of changing your patterns of sociality in order to preserve aspects of the ritual that are important to you. And I'm also thinking, and I'd just like to sort of warn your listeners that I'm going to be talking about death for a moment, so if they don't want to listen, they should probably turn off their radio for a moment or two, that people are talking about what it means to die alone and die infected. And anthropologists are interested in the way that when you when you've got coronavirus, even after your death, you can be regarded as infected, and that creates a whole bunch of related social practices for people around you. Your family can't be with you. The doctors and nurses have to be incredibly careful around you. There are procedures associated with that. And what I want to stress is that anthropologists don't regard those procedures as wrong. What's interesting is what those procedures make happen in the world. And so that's a really fine line, and it's easy to slip on the other side and to say that those procedures, well, they're causing harm, therefore they're not necessary. I think that in some cases, some procedures are unnecessary. But in a lot of cases, the things that are getting done are, as Nancy said, instituted by experts, and they're vital for the health of the health workers, and they're vital for the health of communities. But then there are nevertheless consequences, and anthropologists are always attending to those consequences, the choices that we're making and the way that those choices end up making people feel.
Mm. Yeah. You know, I'd like to give an example from my own situation. I sing in a chorus, a community chorus, and the thing I love most about singing in a chorus, the thing many of us do is we sing together. We produce music together, mm-hmm. and there's no way to do that online. You can sing, and somebody can put all your voices together and make it sound nice. People have been doing that, but it's the together, the producing together, the working together, cooperating and working together and singing that happens in a chorus, but it happens in so many parts of our lives where it is a group effort. It is something that goes across, it's beyond just one person's effort. And I think those things are missing. We are finding ways to substitute for them, but I don't think they're full substitutions. And I know that, I mean, we can talk about skin hunger, but there's all kinds of communal connections that we are used to having and that make our lives so much richer that we are unable to have, certainly not in the same way, but even sometimes not at all. And so we can't hug, and we also can't produce in the same way that we've been used to and that we like.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about the social science perspective of the COVID-19 pandemic. We'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the League of Women Voters of Maine. reminding Mainers to request an absentee ballot for the July 14th election. LWVME.org. And Knox, offering property investors and homeowners planning to move the option of converting their home to an income-producing investment. Learn more at knoxincome.com. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
The Bath Ironworks built USS Nicholas was commissioned by the United States Navy on June 4, 1942. This Fletcher-class destroyer earned 16 battle stars in World War II, placing her among the most decorated U.S. ships of World War II, a total surpassed among destroyers only by her sister ship, the USS O'Bannon. She earned 5 more battle stars in the Korean War and 9 in the Vietnam War, for a total of 30, a number unmatched by any other U.S. Navy ship in the 20th century.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of DN Wealth Advisors and the Maine Seacoast Mission. Happy birthday, Maine!
The world's reporters and producers have a singular mission: to put you in touch with events around the globe that affect life here in the U.S. From the coronavirus to global trade to efforts to dial back climate change, each day we bring you fresh insights, unique voices, one-of-a-kind reporting. Join us for an hour that takes you around the globe. It's right here. It's the world.
And that's coming up this afternoon at 3 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're talking about what social scientists are studying during the COVID-19 pandemic. Joining me, Nancy Riley, who is chair of Bowdoin College's Department of Sociology, and Josh Rubin, who is a lecturer in anthropology, American studies, and Africana at Bates College. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I'll go to an email from Lucy. She writes, "Hearing them talk about how kids interpret risk during this pandemic reminds me of how Black people might talk to their kids about risk surrounding the police. If we're worried about how our children are learning about danger and risk during this medical pandemic, we should also be thinking about it in terms of the pandemic of racism and how it affects non-white kids in our country." Josh, is this something you're thinking about?
This is something.
No, absolutely.
It's such a
disjuncture in a way for us to have a cut to a report about Louisville and then to come back and talk about the coronavirus like they're two separate things. And I know we're trying our very best not to do that, but I really thank this person for writing in and pointing out and calling attention to this directly. I mean, it seems to me in this moment, anthropologists are really invested in experience, how people live, how people feel. And there's a real sort of crisis or a tension in this country between sort of like what Black Americans experience and feel, and then what white Americans recognize and value. And it's not just, of course, white Americans, but it's other populations too that may not experience police violence and police brutality to the same extent.
I'll let you finish.
Oh, no. And so I think that what's really important in this moment is to recognize how different forms of risk are absolutely intertwined. So, right, the risk of who leaves the house and who doesn't is not equally distributed, and the risk of who feels comfortable at a police stop and who doesn't isn't equally distributed. And what's really required, particularly for white Americans, is to recognize that if other people are experiencing, you know, terror in their everyday lives as a result of their fears of sort of social encounters with police or the proximity of police, that's something that needs to be respected and contested. That's the nature of that fear, as much as people's fears about the coronavirus need to be respected and acknowledged.
Nancy.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's related. It's very closely related in the larger sense, which is that blacks and Latinx and Asian Americans and whites have very different outcomes in terms of health and whatever kind of disease or whatever. So, for example, African Americans have higher maternal mortality, higher infant mortality. They have higher rates of death when they in terms of cancers. So the fact that they are at higher risk of getting and dying from COVID-19 is no surprise. And it's not because of something immediate. It's because of the long-standing way that this country has been divided by race and shaped by race, and that's the same thing that's going on in this case in the way in our criminal justice system. And so these things, again, the ways that one of the things that I think the COVID-19 epidemic is really important is that it reveals things about our healthcare system and other things, and it also reveals things about the larger society that we live in that are well beyond COVID-19, and this is one of them. It's race and ethnicity in this country are central in how we have developed as a country and where we are now, and that's true in terms of the deaths that we're witnessing, but also in terms of the last week's actions and terror that people have been facing in the criminal justice system.
I'm going to go to Sherry calling from Portland. Hi, Sherry. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that one of the things that is important to me is to try to figure out ways where I can be socially concerned and responsible in caring for my neighbors by caring for the earth, because I feel that by caring for the environment that we're caring for one another as well. And one of the things that struck me was to try to use our imagination more. So, for example, when we do go to the grocery market or someplace where we would normally have to accept the plastic bags because we're not allowed to bring our own packaging in with us anymore. One of the things I've been doing is putting my groceries back into my shopping cart after I pay for them at the checkout. And then when I get out to the car, to my trunk, I open the trunk and I take everything out of the cart and just put it into the bags into my car and carry my groceries home in my own bags. I do have the privilege of having a car, and I know not everyone has, but it's just another way of, I think, of us trying to use our imaginations to do better for one another and for the earth. Just anything that we can do, that we can be kinder to one another and kinder to our planet that we
Sherry,
all do that.
Yeah, thank you for your call. And I know we have a lot of calls about the grocery bag seems to have really touched a nerve with people. And I think it's the swing between something many of us have come to do regularly, and suddenly we're having to change the way we think about something just like that.
But maybe I think this is a good suggestion. We're finding ways to adapt to the new circumstances using our longstanding values and trying to figure out how to carry them forward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm going to move on. Let's see, to Nancy calling from Topsom. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
I studied anthropology at Stanford and many years ago, 45 years ago, and now I've been concerned all my life with social change towards protecting the environment and reducing population. And I see a lot of exciting things happening in these times where people are spending more time at home. They're thinking about the energy efficiency and the electrical and heat or cooling use of their houses and taking advantage of the efficiency main programs that give them rebates for putting in a heat pump hot water heater or insulation or weatherizing their house. They're looking at putting in solar electric systems. Maine has a law that requires us to cut our energy use to increase the amount of green power, wind and solar.
Right, Nancy. I think you make a really good point, and I think that a lot of people have sort of commented on how maybe this is shifting our perspective and making us think more deeply about some things. But Josh, I'm guessing that you would also say that that's not something that all of us are able to do right now. That this is your whole point, is that some of us are able to think, oh, maybe this is the time I'm going to put the solar panels on my home, or I'm going to pick up bicycling again. But many people don't have that option.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point. I would also add these last two callers are doing a really good job of sort of imagining what the conditions are putting on them and using that as an opportunity to think in different ways about how they want to be in the world. And I would actually encourage those people and plenty of other folks too to not limit their focus to the environment and to their carbon footprint, though that is obviously vital, but to think about social life and to think about the institutions that they operate in. There's going to be a lot of pressures to be austere financially and institutionally in the coming months as different bodies try to accommodate the financial sort of consequences of the coronavirus. And now is actually potentially a moment for people to think creatively and expansively about how to interact with other people and how to build communities with each other. And so in the wake of the process of our current protest environment surrounding the death of Black Americans at the hands of police, I would encourage those people who are thinking about solar panels to also think about, all right, what forms of sociality can we invent right now in this midst of shifting environments to kind of attend to those inequities outside of sort of the environment and our concerns there. And so I know that that requires for some kind of a shift away from the home and from what feels most comfortable and the routines of life. But this is a really, really novel, really disorienting moment. And in that disorientation can come new institutions, can come better institutions. And so I think Nancy's point about attending to the things that we hold dear is vital, and then sort of seeing how can we transform those and improve those and make them better for more people going forward, I think is equally important.
And I Nancy. Think, I mean, just, yeah, I think speaking to that, I think that's a really good point, Josh. And I think recognizing, so we've sort of, I feel like the inside is now, the inside of our systems are now much more visible. And so recognizing what those insides are and how, for example, inequality has played such an important role in so many things, and how do we deal with that? So how do we take care of the people who have fewer resources, who have less voice, or whose voice is less often heard, rather? And how do we do that going forward? How do we take that going forward and continue to pay attention and to think about those things? I think that's a really good point, Josh.
Nancy, thanks for your call. Lauren on Facebook writes, I have a 10-month-old daughter who had respiratory issues at birth, and we have been social distancing and pretty much quarantining ourselves, except for work and the exception of two grandparents who are as well social distancing. Before the pandemic hit, my daughter and I used to be able to go out and socialize and explore the world and see different people. Now that we can't go anywhere, I find myself relying on video chatting with people which she loves, or using the TV for her to be able to see different people like Sesame Street. My main concern is her growing up and being so secluded from other people. How is she going to manage when we get back on track? The only way to communicate is through screens now, and she loves to see people on the screen. So I feel in some capacity, what we've been recommending for these infants and toddlers is going to change tremendously. And how is that going to affect them in the future? Really poignant post, Lauren. And also, Nancy, thinking about how this relationship with screens might be changing us into the future.
Yeah, and I think about children and how much of our socialization is from the kids around us at schools. Oftentimes we spend, you know, kids spend so much time at school and they're not doing that. And so, you know, I think screens are one thing, but you don't get the same interaction with people on screens. You get something, but you don't get the whole thing. And I really wonder about what that's going to mean for children. I do think that children are really at the center of some of these fundamental changes, because they just don't have the memory of the long memory that some of us do about, you know, another way to live.
Mm-hmm. Josh, thoughts before we move on?
Yeah, I'm glad to participate in this. My current work is about video game development, and certainly video games have had a very complicated relationship with popular press and politicians in past decades, as people have sort of linked video games I would think, in, I would argue, in very superficial ways to social violence. And it seems to me that, yes, I'm pretty confident that people's, like, children's deep engagement with screens is going to change their sociality in important ways. But I would also caution people against sort of assuming that screens are going to destroy, like, childhood sociality or something like that. And I know that Nancy was saying nothing of the kind. And so I want to make that very clear. But there's a way in which new media are understood by people who are familiar with older media that tends to make those new media seem dangerous in a way that older media are not. And actually, if you do a historical sort of analysis of media across time, you realize that every new form of media is viewed with suspicion and anxiety by generations that were not brought up with it. And so I would say maybe it's perhaps better to imagine the ways that sociality is going to change than to think that, for example, sitting a child in front of a television for whatever length of time you need for the purposes of your own mental health or for their own education or for you to get a bit of time to work or something like that, that you shouldn't put pressure on yourself if you're a parent for having to make those hard choices, because it's not inherent in the screen that it's going to be harmful to a child. It's what they're viewing on the screen, and it's how the screen is understood. It's the forms of sociality that surround the screen and all of that stuff. Those are much more profound than maybe we tend to reckon with when we focus on the idea of a young child looking at a screen for most of the day.
I'm going to try to squeeze in one more call. And we, Will, if you could be quick, that'd be great.
Yeah, definitely. I was just calling because I've been observing my own reactions to living. It's so seasonal, and the summers are such a big spot for people from away to come in and enjoy the place that we get to enjoy as well. And a part of that has been an initial reaction of fear. And I've been observing my own reactions to that and just curious of your perspectives of, like, how can we accept people coming in just as we do with immigrants and people seeking
Sure, Will. Yeah, your phone cut out a little bit, but you were talking about tourists coming from out of state into Maine and the fear of that right now and how it might be tied into sort of fears about immigration and things. Nancy, we only have a few seconds, so if you have some really quick thoughts on what Will has to say.
Sure. I just think that, again, we are viewing people with suspicion. And, you know, whether it's somebody with New York license plates or somebody who we think is an immigrant by the way they look, I think it's the same thing, that we're making quick judgments oftentimes not necessarily based on what's going on. And I think we have to figure out a way to make that easier on the people that we're seeing as strangers and potentially dangerous.
Well, thank you all so much for your thoughts, and Will, for that final thought. Very interesting. Nancy Riley, chair of Bowdoin College's Department of Sociology and a professor of social sciences. She's currently working on a project on Chinese in Hawaii and another on gender and reproductive control across the globe. Josh Rubin, a lecturer in anthropology, American studies, and Africana at Bates College, who's finishing up a book about the politics and aesthetics of South African rugby to be published by the University of Michigan Press. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Today's CDC briefing was early. It started at 1 o'clock. You can watch it at the Maine Public website, mainepublic.org. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.